I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Amelia Saltzman, the award-winning cookbook author of The Seasonal Jewish Kitchen, A Fresh Take on Tradition. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Two Jewish Mavina on Israel, Oshrat Borel, and our Maven on Jewish Education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Cheerful subject today. In the past 2 years, fears of a global pandemic have exploded. Last year, our Earth was terrified by the explosive spread of the Ebola virus in Africa, which killed tens of thousands of people and threatened to spread worldwide. There were cover articles on Ebola in every mainstream magazine. The internet was filled with horror stories of the imminent danger Ebola posed to all humanity. Air travel to and from Africa was nearly interdicted. This year, we have the less terrifying but still bizarre and shocking Zika virus, which causes babies to be born with tiny heads, called microcephaly, and threatens all pregnant women. In fact, just this last week, Congress took funds originally directed to fight Ebola and moved them to fight Zika. Seemingly, each year, another severely dangerous disease appears, and the world reacts with horror and fear. There have been a number of feature films made that use this very real issue in sensationalistic ways. The latest is the current B-movie, Pandemic, in theaters now. Luckily, the worst fears in these movies have not been realized, at least in the developed world, at least so far. We are fortunate that today we have a rapid response pattern to new public health threats. We are advanced enough to avoid the worst consequences of the various viruses, bacteria, and immune system perils that threaten our lives. But it was not always so. For most of human history, the threat of epidemic disease and the inexplicable spread of a new plague was a terrifying precursor to massive deaths and profound societal disruption. Until the late 19th century, the germ theory of disease wasn't known or widely accepted, and people believed that bubonic plague, influenza, smallpox, and cholera, all cheerful, which killed large percentages of the population of whole countries, were caused by evil odors from decaying plants or wells that were poisoned by minority groups, you know, like Jews. In the absence of anything constructive to do about these epidemics, terror and witch hunting flourished. More recently, the AIDS crisis brought back many of the worst aspects of pre-germ theory responses to disease. In the presence of grave fears engendered by inexplicable and fatal disease, our society struggled to understand the illness, avoid its spread, and offer compassion and treatment to the afflicted. Often we failed to accomplish all of these goals, sometimes any of them, and there were long periods where fear and demonization were rampant. Interestingly, the book of Leviticus, written at least 2,500 years ago, addressed this exact situation. A poorly understood disease, called leprosy, but we don't really know what it was, endangered the Israelite community. There was no obvious cure. What does the Torah tell our ancestors to do about it? Well, first, the Torah explains that a proper diagnosis had to be obtained from a qualified expert. In this case, the priest. The affected individual was placed into quarantine, a benign isolation to ascertain if the ailment had been correctly diagnosed over time. Once it's clear that the illness has been identified, the cures that were available then, purification with water, isolation to see if the individual would heal, rest, prayer, sacrifice, are attempted. If the person heals or is determined not to be contagious, that patient is returned to society. Finally, if the illness does not abate after a suitable waiting period, the individual must remain isolated from non-afflicted people. This process is very similar to contemporary public health measures we take today. In 2016, in instances of potential epidemic, we diagnose, isolate, quarantine, treat, and allow time to heal. Where we have medication to address the illness, we administer it. If the disease can be controlled and reversed, the person is restored to the regular population. If the illness continues and appears to be contagious, we isolate them from infecting others. In the Torah, there is no notion that an ill person has been punished for sin or contracted illness because of a moral defect. Instead, the emphasis is on making a difficult process both scrupulously careful and compassionate. We try to bring God's healing into the world, and we understand that we can't guarantee it will actually work. The affected, afflicted individual must be isolated for everyone's good, but he or she must not be treated with revulsion or fear. The Torah does not present an ideal medical system, nor do we have one today. But Judaism's message of conscientious care and respect for the patient is one that our own medical industry could relearn today. The empathy demonstrated for the infected in the Torah, as well as the absolute refusal to demonize the ill, well, these have much to teach our society as a whole. We are now approaching the great Freedom Festival of Pesach, and to play us in this morning, here's a short medley from our Passover preview, B'chol Dor V'Dor and Shalach Ami, sung by my father, Cantor Baruch Kohan, and me. In every generation, each of us must see ourselves as though we had personally come out of slavery in Egypt, combined with Let My People Go. B'chol Dor V'Dor, Hayav Adam Lirot Et Atzmo Ke'ilo Ke'ilo Yatsa Min Mitzrayim That was a Passover music preview from me and my dad. The first Seder is less than 2 weeks away now, Friday night, April 22nd. Our Temple Emmanuel Community Seders are on Saturday night, April 23rd. Call 520-327-4501 to make reservations for this fabulous night celebrating freedom and good food. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish, Amelia Saltzman, is a delightful and highly successful award-winning cookbook author whose new book, The Seasonal Jewish Kitchen, A Fresh Take on Tradition, explains how to make Jewish food delicious and healthy, both. Find out when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998, and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones, so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
Hi, I'm Ben, a student at Tucson Hebrew Academy. Attention Arizona taxpayers, you can provide Jewish education to families at no cost to you. Direct your Arizona state tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization, and help make great Jewish education affordable. Here's how it works. Arizona lets taxpayers receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to JETCO. JETCO gives scholarships to kids who attend private schools like Anshe Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, serving students from K-8. Tax credits are different from a tax deduction. When you give to JETCO, you get a 100% tax credit. That means your Arizona state income tax is reduced by the exact amount you've given. You can give up to $1,067 for a single filer and $2,134 for a married couple. You get that whole amount back from your state income tax. Give JETCO a call at 647-8442. That's 647-8442, or go to JETCO.org. You can even choose a future date to process your payment. How cool is that? Make a tax credit contribution to JETCO and build Jewish identity in Tucson for generations of students. And it won't cost you a dime.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Amelia Saltzman is a writer, teacher, and author best known for her cookbooks. The Seasonal Jewish Kitchen, A Fresh Take on Tradition, is the latest. And her award-winning The Santa Monica Farmer's Market Cookbook, Seasonal Food, Simple Recipes, Stories from the Market and the Farm. She has a reputation for fresh ingredients and combining fascinating and interesting foods to take fresh takes on both traditional and non-traditional foods. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you. Good morning to you, Rabbi.
So, what's the best perk of being a cookbook author? Do you get to get the best food anywhere you go, or...
Wow, what a question. I suppose it depends on if you ask my family or if you ask me. So for me, the best perk, I think, is just having, being able to be in the moment of seeing what foods have to say to you and how they want to come together. I really think it's a wonderful thing, and I wish more people would just listen to their food and let the food tell them what to do.
You have a really fascinating personal biography in terms of, you know, kind of being born from two very different Jewish traditions. Can you describe that a little bit?
Well, my mother is Romanian, which would be Ashkenazic or European tradition. And my father is Iraqi. He was born in Iraq, which is what we call Sephardic or Mediterranean.
Maybe Mediterranean Oriental, actually, you might say.
Exactly. And but my parents, as children, each of their families moved to Israel, to Palestine, in the early 30s. So my parents were raised in Israel, and they met in the army. So right away, we have all of these different traditions, the sort of Balkan, Romanian, Latin, Ottoman sort of thing going on. And then we have the very Iraqi Middle Eastern traditions, and then the giant explosion of experiences that you have of Israeli food, which is so many cultures coming together. But I was born and raised in Los Angeles. My parents came to study here in Los Angeles, and that's another influence that I've experienced. So it all comes together in this wonderful melting pot of experiences, and it kind of frees me up to not be rigid with any one particular tradition and see all the possibilities. Maybe that's the best perk of all.
That's a great perk, and we'll talk much more with Amelia Saltzman, the author of The Seasonal Jewish Kitchen, A Fresh Take on Tradition, when we come back in just a few moments here on Two Jewish.
We welcome Pam and David of Freedom Smoke. So your product, a smokeless way to get off of tobacco, people don't really understand exactly what's wrong with cigarettes, or they think it's the same thing that's wrong with your product. Can you explain the difference?
That's true, Rabbi Kohan. Part of it is cigarettes themselves, the FDA made them release the ingredients. There's over 3,000 ingredients in cigarettes. There's four ingredients in electronic cigarettes. Propylene glycol, vegetable glycerine, flavorings from Flavor Art in Italy, who is who we use, and nicotine itself Our nicotine is USP hospital grade. It's the finest that you can purchase. Nicotine in and of itself is not harmful to the human body. That's why we have so many doctors referring patients that they just cannot get to quit smoking cigarettes. They send them to us for a much healthier alternative.
And where do people go and how do they find your stuff?
They can go to one of our three stores here in Tucson. We've got one at Orange Grove and River, one at Broadway and Swan, and one at 12th and Valencia. Or they can go online to freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thanks very much, and we'll talk next week.
Thank Always you. A pleasure.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com, TOO Jewish Radio 18, or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, twojewishradio.com, or stream us or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We have about 7 months until we elect a new president of these United States. We continue our election year feature, the 2016 Two Jewish Presidential Report. Well, Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders had both a good week and a bad one. The only Jewish candidate won the Wisconsin primary over Hillary Clinton, but the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, called on him to correct misstatements he made regarding the 2014 conflict between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. In an interview with the New York Daily News, Sanders said Israel's actions during the 2014 war in Gaza were disproportionate. "My recollection is over 10,000 innocent people were killed in Gaza," Bernie said. That's inaccurate, a tremendous overstatement. Even the highest number of casualties claimed by Palestinian sources that include Hamas members engaged in attacking Israel is five times less than the number cited by Bernie Sanders, said ADL CEO Jonathan Greenblatt. As Sanders publicly discusses his approach to key U.S. foreign policy priorities, including Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, accuracy and accountability are essential for the voting public, also for the U.S. credibility in the international community. Greenblatt said, "We urge Senator Sanders to correct his misstatements." Bernie Sanders also said that if Israel wanted to have a positive relationship with the U.S., it would have to improve its relationship with the Palestinians. When pushed to elaborate on Sanders' past calls for Israel to pull back from the West Bank settlements, he said, "Long-term, we cannot ignore the reality that you have large numbers of Palestinians who are suffering now. Poverty rate off the charts, unemployment off the charts, Gaza remaining a destroyed area." Unlike his memory of the casualty numbers in Gaza, these are true statements. However, they are not likely to gain Bernie more Jewish votes. That was our 2016 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, with the recent attacks, terror attacks in Brussels and the increasing flow of immigrants into Europe, there's also been a concomitant rise in right-wing parties and the strength of right-wing parties. But I don't just mean right-wing, you know, extremist, neo-Nazi-influenced or even neo-Nazi parties in parts of Europe where we really don't want to see that happen. Can you talk about that?
I'm not sure there's any part of Europe in which we want to see it happen, but
I stand corrected.
It may be particularly scary when it happens in Germany, where a far-right party has made striking gains recently in reaction to Angela Merkel's policy of welcoming refugees and basically saying, yes, we can, and there's no limit to how many we can absorb, blah, blah, blah. The far right in Germany has reacted strongly against that. And I think this goes back, in one sense, to something we've discussed earlier on this show, which is what often looks to American Jews like a rise in anti-Semitism in Europe is, in fact, nothing other than a rise in a sentiment of siege, of fear of the other, and discrimination against the other. And historically in Europe, that was Jews, because for 1,000 years or more, there were no other minorities in Western Europe. There were Catholics. There may have been a few Protestants who were discriminated against, but the visible, really different minority was Jews. Now, the visible, really different minority is Muslims, who in some countries have a huge influence in the polls. So electorates and politicians have to if not pander to them, at least pay attention to them, and their presence in ever-growing numbers scares nationalists, scares people who are insecure about their own identities, about their national identity, about their job future, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, what you have is a number of interrelated factors operating in common. I think we should look at each one separately. One is the refugee crisis caused not only by the civil war in Syria, but also by endless civil wars in Lebanon, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, by intra-Islamic conflicts throughout the Islamic world. Dozens of countries in the Middle East and in North Africa are sources of refugees trying to get into Europe by any means. So one source of problems for European politics is the refugee crisis. Another source of problems is the ongoing economic crisis, which was worldwide, which began now almost 10 years ago, and which is seeing a slower recovery, generally speaking, in Europe than in the U.S. And the third thing is simply lower birth rate among quote-unquote real Germans, whatever that means, or real Austrians, or real French, meaning white, Christian, French, Germans, Austrians, and a higher birth rate among newer Germans or newer Austrians who may be of Turkish origin or Syrian origin or whatever. And that changes the complexion of the politics and the culture. So all three of those factors play into this, and I think we should look at each one separately.
We'll talk about it next time. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivi Nan, Israel Oshart Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshart.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So in America, the difference between Sephardic and Ashkenazic Jewry is not so critical. It isn't on people's minds. In Israel, it is. Can you explain some of that? Why is it so qualitatively different?
Yeah, well, I try to explain here one of the lectures, what's the difference. And, you know, in Israel, it's a heavy topic. It's related to emotions. The Ashkenaz came to Israel first. They built their nation, and then they decide they were on the government, and they decided that the Sephardi Jews that came from Iraq and Morocco early 50s, 60s, to put them on, you know,
Mabarot,
on the borders, because someone needed to defend
put them in the
Israel
development
borders.
Towns, don't let them exactly. be in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv.
And right. I saw like people in the room like, really don't understand what I'm talking about. I was all about, since I'm from a Sephardi family, and I heard all these stories. So let's start at the beginning and say that, you know, in general, Sephardic are all these Jews who came from Spain, Sfarad.
Descended from the Jews of Spain and Portugal,
yeah.
were expelled in 1492, but also that whole culture, which was really all of North Africa.
Yes. But that's
all the way
the word,
to Egypt, and the Balkans as well.
Bidiuk. So that's Sephardic. Ashkenaz, it's all the rest.
Everybody else. Now that's not really true, because there's Edot HaMizrach who are kind of Sephardic, but not really, and they're certainly not Ashkenazic. So there's the Oriental Jews of Yemen, Iraq, Iran.
Nahon.
But for our purposes, really, Ashkenazic and Sephardic is the Jews from Spain, Portugal, North Africa, and even the Oriental Jews are really classed with the Sephardim in most people's
definitely
minds.
In Israel. Like
Israel,
I just
sure.
recently heard about the third part, but in Israel it's like all everything almost is black and white, so Sephardic and Ashkenaz.
Right, and so what it really means is the Ashkenazic Jews are the Jews from theoretically descended from the Jews of Germany, but really it's any European Jews who are not Sephardim or
exactly.
Oriental Jews or not from the East.
Exactly. So in Israel, definitely in every town, not just in a large towns, every town you will find enough Sephardic shuls and enough Ashkenaz shuls. And it's not just Ashkenaz and Sephardi. You will have one Iraqi, Yamani, few Moroccans.
Turkish,
you know.
Everybody.
So definitely, it starts and ends with shuls, but and definitely with food. And we talked about food. So Sephardic and Ashkenaz food. But it's also a lot of traditions. The traditions that related to, of course, tefillot.
So the prayers are
prayers.
Slight. Now, to an outside observer, the prayers themselves won't seem terribly different, but the melodies are very different.
Definitely,
And the
yeah.
musical cultures are extremely different.
Yeah. And also, like, if we're close to Passover, there is all kind of different tradition that related to holidays. And for Passover, of course, ochle kitniot, not kitniot.
Right, so the Sephardi meat rice and peas, which always scandalized my Ashkenazic family, because how could they possibly eat stuff that we aren't supposed to eat on Passover? And so there are certain, which to an outside non-Jew would look like the tiniest differences, but culturally are quite large within the Jewish world.
And some of the Mizrahi, like Sephardis, will eat, like, we won't eat even garlic on Passover.
They won't eat garlic on Passover.
So which there is all
you
kind
can't
of
make Ashkenazic food without garlic. It's against the law.
And you know why they don't eat garlic?
I have no idea. I've never
because
understood
it's
that.
Because when it's like a,
when it flowers?
No, it's puffed. Like kmo chametz, like it's not machmitz, but it's grow.
Because it expands as though it were like wheat. It's one of those fascinating things.
That's the explanation I got from my grandma. I never understand it, and I'm not asking you
I still
understand.
Don't, and I don't think our audience does, but there are differences between Sephardic and Ashkenazic that are not so easy to resolve. Thanks so much, Ashra.
Toda rabbi.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Boker Tov.
Boker Or. So Pesach is coming up soon.
Yay.
Boy, you know, Passover is, and the Seder and the Haggadah are perhaps the greatest pedagogic tools ever created by human beings.
Yeah.
Forces you to engage, to be focused, to think, and to use all of your senses so many different ways. I have noticed something, though. Younger kids love Pesach until they, you know, run out of energy.
Mm.
Older kids, that is, particularly teenagers, clue out pretty quickly. How do we change? What do you suggest for the Seders out there this year?
Wow, that's a great question. And when we talk pedagogy, what we're talking about is the structure, the strategies for teaching and learning. And you're absolutely right that the Passover Seder has this tried and true methodology. But the Seder gets a little long. And of course, you know, the younger kids are drinking grape juice, hopefully. And so the hook that entertains adults might not be as strong, but Passover, I hear from kids, is their favorite holiday. It's certainly mine. And I think part of that is the food. Part of that is the sense of community. It's the special table. It's the way that you have this big feast with a lot of people around together. And, you know, young kids are on the hook right up till the Afikomen is revealed and shared, because there's that big prize dangling at the end. But also, there's a lot of fun to be had post Afikomen with the songs. And so we get really crazy when we do the songs at our Seder table. And this might work for yours as well. For example, as we do Haggadah, we go crazy with all kinds of sounds and noises that the different animals make, and hand gestures, and sort of miming things out. When we do the 13 attributes, we also sing that with a lot of energy and hand motions and participation. So it's that tried and true, getting kids involved, giving them tasks that they can do that happen throughout the Seder. So one can look for those opportunities. As, you know, we're opening the door for Elijah, a team of kids can go and run and do that. And maybe they can look around for Elijah. Maybe they can carefully watch the wine cup to see that a little bit is missing after Eliyahu Hanavi leaves the room. When we're talking about the Maror and the Charoset, those are also moments where the kids at the table can pick those pieces up and share them around. When we do the hand washing, that's something that the children can help to facilitate. So those little strategies for get them up every once in a while, get their hands on something, get them moving around, helps maintain that level of interest.
You know, at my Seder at home, every single person participates and in multiple times. So that way, nobody has an excuse not to be connected.
Absolutely. Passing the storytelling around the table. And, of course, you can tell it in Aramaic or Hebrew or English. You can ad lib. You can read off the text.
We ask the questions in like 20 different languages. So you get Spanish, Ladino. We've had Japanese, all kinds of stuff. Lots of ways of connecting. Thanks, John. All great strategies for making a great learning experience about freedom more powerful still.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through 8th grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A group of seniors are sitting around talking about their ailments. "My arms are so weak I can hardly lift this cup of coffee," says one. "Yes, I know," says another. "My cataracts are so bad I can't even see my coffee. I couldn't even mark an X at the election because my hands are so crippled," volunteers a third. "What? I can't hear you. Speak up," says an elderly lady. "I can't turn my head because of arthritis in my neck," says another. "My blood pressure pills make me dizzy all the time," exclaims her friend. "I forget where I am and where I'm going," says a man. The others all nod. "Well, count your blessings," says a woman cheerfully. "Thank God we can all still drive." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Metzorah focuses on the question of leprosy, a dread disease in the ancient world, but mostly an archaic and pretty disgusting section to read today. Exploring what our ancestors believed to be an infectious disease at great length during a Shabbos service is not so spiritually meaningful. The rabbis recognized this problem long ago and came up with an ingenious reinterpretation. The word Metzorah, which means leprosy, was itself an abbreviation for the term in Hebrew, Motzi Shem Ra. That means slander or evil speech. Our moral goal in life should be to completely eliminate from our lives and habits Motzi Shem Ra, the awful tendency we have to speak ill of others, a kind of interpersonal leprosy. According to Judaism, we must take even greater care to avoid the circulation of anonymous slander. Hiding behind the cloak of anonymity compounds the sin of Lashon Hara with the taint of genuine cowardice. We are told in the Talmud that gossip kills three people: the one who speaks it, the one about whom it is spoken, and even the one who merely listens to it. How much more is that true of genuine slander, Motzi Shem Ra, the act of publicly defaming another person? There's a solution to this. Commit no slander, and your own life will be made clean of moral illness. By purifying our speech of words that damage others, we can find our way clear to living better, holier lives. The portion this week even delineates forms of Metzora that affect the houses in which we live, Metzora Ad Bayit. If a house is badly enough infected with this leprosy of the property, it may even need to be destroyed. This is along the lines of the prophetic concept, borrowed by Abraham Lincoln, that a house divided against itself cannot stand. If we wish to have not only personal lives, but organizations, synagogues, Jewish communities in which holiness can flourish, the dreadful sin of slander must be eliminated as well. May we each do our part, now and always, to remove Metzora, personal impurities of speech and action, from our own lives, from our homes, from our organizations. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, Anita Saltzman, will explain what makes Jewish food so compellingly delicious, how to make it not only tasty but healthy. Find out when we return shortly here on To Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us?
The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998, and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israel Aircraft Industries, IAI, announced last week it had made new sales to India worth hundreds of millions of dollars. They included drones, air defense and radar systems, and other products. The announcement came at the end of India's DefExpo 2016 exhibition in Goa, which saw 28 Israeli defense firms exhibit goods at the Israeli pavilion. Joseph Weiss, president and CEO of Israel Aircraft Industries, said, "The sales signed in the past months strengthen India's position as a major partner of IAI. We will continue our long-term strategic partnership with India, meet our customers' expectations, and implement a Made in India policy led by India's Prime Minister." IAI also said it expanded its operation in cooperation with India's military branches, Navy and Air Force, Coast Guard, Border Security, and other agencies. Over the past 25 years, Israel has sold many defense systems to the Indian Ministry of Defense, as well as establishing subcontracting agreements and joint ventures with a range of Indian companies. In other news, the number of anti-Semitic incidents reported in Austria increased by more than 80% last year, according to the Austrian Forum Against Anti-Semitism. 465 incidents were recorded during 2015, about 200 of them internet postings hostile to Jews. "The whole picture is terrifying," said Oscar Deutsch, president of the Jewish Communities of Austria. There's a clear trend of increasingly hostile behavior by Muslims against the 15,000 Jews living in Austria, a Jewish community representative said. There's an increasing concern in our community that if the proportion of Muslims in Austria continues to rise due to immigration and the refugees, this could become problematic for us, Raymond Fastenbauer said. In several European countries, including France and the Netherlands, watchdog groups attribute most anti-Semitic incidents to immigrants from Muslim countries. In anti-Semitic news closer to home, a member of Stanford University's Student Senate argued that it is not anti-Semitism to claim Jews control the media, economy, government, and other social institutions. Gabriel Knight, a junior, made the remark at a Student Senate meeting last week addressing a proposed resolution on anti-Semitism, according to the Stanford Daily, the main campus newspaper. Knight also said, "Questioning these potential power dynamics, I think, is not anti-Semitism." He apologized later in the meeting after Jewish community leaders and a Jewish student accused him of anti-Semitism. A point of contention in the Stanford debate was a clause that deemed demonizing, delegitimizing, and applying double standards to Israel as anti-Semitic. The Senate voted to delete that, saying it would restrict legitimate criticism of Israeli policy. Like demonizing, you know. According to the Stanford Review, some at the meeting also questioned whether the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, was qualified to educate about anti-Semitism. That's fascinating, as the ADL has been educating about anti-Semitism for a century.
This is the theme to Gary Show. The theme to Gary Show. Gary called me up and asked if I would write his theme song. I'm almost halfway finished. How do you like it so far? How do you like the theme to Gary Show?
Comedian Gary Shandling died last week of a heart attack. Shandling grew up here in Tucson, Arizona, where his mom owned a pet store and his dad had a print shop and where he was bar mitzvahed. He graduated from the University of Arizona before moving to L.A. and becoming a comedy writer for Sanford and Son and Welcome Back, Cotter. But after surviving a near-fatal car accident, he decided to change careers. Frustrated by the formulaic nature of sitcom TV in the 70s, he instead became a stand-up comic. Shandling started out at the Comedy Store in Hollywood. There he was involved in an anti-union situation, actually. Then took his act on the road, was spotted by a talent scout for Johnny Carson. His first appearance was memorable.
I ate dinner last night at a friend of mine's house, and he has, what do you call those things? Baby. He has a baby, and I'm a single guy. I don't know how to relate to this too well, you know, and the baby's crawling around on the carpet, and this baby loads up his diaper, you know, and I'm sitting there, you know, and the mother comes over and says, "Isn't that adorable? Brandon made a gift for Daddy." Now, I'm figuring this guy's got to be real easy to shop for on Father's Day.
Gary Shandling became a favorite on The Tonight Show, a frequent guest host, and turned down a chance to replace David Letterman on The Late Show in order to create his own fake late-night shows. First, It's Gary Shandling's Show, and then The Larry Sanders Show. Both shows broke the model of late-night TV wide open, removed the fourth wall, and were hysterically funny. Shandling was nominated for a slew of Emmys, 22 in all, and The Larry Sanders Show won 3. Shandling hosted the Grammys and Emmys and appeared in a variety of movies, and his voice will be in the new Jungle Book film, sadly, posthumously. Gary Shandling was just 66 years old. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Amelia Saltzman, is the author of The Seasonal Jewish Kitchen, A Fresh Take on Tradition. She's an award-winning cookbook writer who also appears frequently on radio and TV. Her work has appeared in all kinds of publications, from Bon Appetit to the LA Times, Boston Globe, Huffington Post, National Geographic Traveler, and much more. Jewish food, you know, one of the things that you have made kind of a hallmark of your work is using farm to table, the freshest ingredients, kind of the best stuff. You know, what I know of Jewish food traditionally is it's delicious, Ashkenazic Jewish food, but light it isn't, and it isn't always the freshest vegetable cooked more than within an inch of its life. How do you reinterpret some of these traditions?
Well, the first thing is, we have to, rather than even just reinterpreting, we have to look at the variety of cooks out there. Because even an Ashkenazic tradition, a modern Ashkenazic tradition, isn't necessarily cooking vegetables to within an inch of their life. It all depends on the cook. And while it's true that traditional foods 100 years ago or 150 years ago were often long cooked and braised, that's true of just about any cuisine. We've really changed over the last 10, 20, 30, even 40 years as an entire sort of group in how we like our vegetables and so on. But really, there's such a wealth of food out there that Jewish people consider their own. Because, you know, Jews have been on the move for thousands of years. They've lived pretty much anywhere, everywhere. So there isn't only one kind of Jewish food. Never has been.
You know, one of the things that sort of occurred to me not very long ago, I'm not too quick on the uptake, is that a lot of the traditional Ashkenazic Jewish foods, but also Sephardic Jewish foods, are made from fairly inexpensive ingredients. You know, brisket is the toughest cut of meat unless you cook it forever. Gefilte fish means you chop up all the fish and put it together so you can't tell if it was super fresh or if it was a really nice variety, uh-huh. Things like that. We weren't rich people, so we made do with what we had. We're kind of in a different situation now.
Well, I think in the United States, we've had a tradition, not that long a tradition, really. We've had a tradition of only the best cuts of beef, let's say, that sort of thing. But that isn't a world tradition. The world tradition, and certainly even 50 or 60 years ago, 100 years ago in the United States, everybody ate nose to tail and ate everything. And so I think it's hard to pigeonhole, as they say in Italian, a cucina povera. It's true in every society that there are foods that we cook, long braises of lesser cuts of meat and that sort of thing. It's true, but it's also true that there have always been well-to-do people and in any culture. And certainly the Iraqi and the, you know, many of the Middle Eastern Jewish cultures have been very wealthy through time. If you've ever gone to, let's say, the Jewish Museum in Paris, you'll see the most remarkable, beautiful silver accoutrement and traditional silver candlesticks and bowls and serving dishes and so on that bespoke of great wealth. And certainly in Europe you have the Baron de Hirsch family and the Rothschild family who did so much to provide for Jews less fortunate. So we always have to remember, I like to think, that there isn't just one way or one socioeconomic approach to food. And what I think that does is really free us up to experience all the deliciousness. Because really, there is so much to enjoy all over, you know, throughout Jewish cooking.
You have always focused in your work on fresh, seasonal cooking. Jewish food is always seasonal based on holidays. What holiday was the most fun for you to work on? What foods? Mm-hmm. And how did you express that?
Well, I do think we forget how truly seasonal the Jewish calendar is. It, after all, it follows the natural cycles of the year. It's a lunar calendar in the same way that the growing season calendar is. So that's always something nice to remember. And it was a natural extension of, as you say, the farm-to-table work that I do. So reconnecting those dots was really lovely, and I hope many more people will do that to see the relationship between present and past. I would say that I think that working through the book, all of the holidays were really fun, some more surprising than others. Of course, we're coming soon to Passover, Purim and Passover, the next holidays that we'll be experiencing. And taking Passover, for instance, most of us in America don't think about the fact that Passover is in the month of Nisan, which is actually the first month of the year. You know, we think about the Jewish New Year, and we think maybe that's the first month, but that's not. That's the seventh month and a harvest month down the line later in the year. But that first month of the year is like a new year for the growing season. So Passover, which we associate with freedom and escape and that sort of thing, is also the beginning, the rebirth of the growing season, and of course, the rebirth of a nation, that moment of Exodus. So there's this natural tie-in, and when you look at the foods of the Seder plates, they are all about new spring foods. So just seeing that was so exciting for me. Of course, we have all these wonderful spring herbs. We have the lamb. We have the egg. All of these are universal symbols of renewal and spring. And isn't that wonderful? And I think it brings the Seder plate, it gives an added layer of meaning in our contemporary lives. And I think it can enrich our experience and make the Seder a more relevant observation on more levels. I think it's just a wonderful opportunity to just tie in a lot of things. And so it's what's wonderful is that these are the foods that we see wherever we live to one degree or another. These are the foods that we see in the marketplace. Isn't that marvelous?
In the course of developing this cookbook, you had to leave something out, right? Because you always do. What did you have to leave out?
Enough to write another cookbook.
So we will look forward to the next edition of this wonderful book, The Seasonal Jewish Kitchen. It'll be the next set of seasons.
Well, or the next set of recipes anyway. I mean, at some point I was having so much fun coming up with these recipes that were both just rediscovering my grandmother's recipes that resonate today, that are just delicious today without a single change, to coming up with new ideas that still ring true, not tricked up, not fancy, that I finally had to say, oh, wait, stop, you've got to turn this in. So it's pretty great and pretty exciting. And if you think that Jewish food is dull or irrelevant, you better crack this book open, and I've got a thing or two to say.
Highly recommended. You can also go to AmeliaSaltzman.com, Amelia, SaltzMan.com, to learn more. Thank you so much for a great visit here on Too Jewish.
Well, thank you. It was my pleasure. I enjoyed it a lot.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
On April 10th, the stars will be out and Vegas will come to Tucson for a charity gala at the Fox, featuring an evening with Elton, Cher, Streisand, and Midler. Performed by world-famous impersonators, the Edwards Twins, and emceed by our own David Fitzsimmons. Details at comedyforcharity.org.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Father Sean Carroll, the executive director of the Keno Border Initiative. Our playout this morning comes from three Jewish tenors, cantors all, friends of mine from long ago, Alberto Mizrahi, David Propus, and Meir Finkelstein, singing Ki Lo Na'a and Chad Gadya, songs from the Passover Seder, originally created by the great cantor Moshe Oysher. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace. Hagat ye hagariya.